Hello and welcome to Arts Alive, the podcast of the St. Pete Catalyst. My name is Bill DeYoung. I'm here today with Mr. Jeremy Carter, saxophone player extraordinaire. Hello, sir.
Hey, hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
Man, we got a lot to talk about jazz in Tampa Bay, because it's a subject that it goes deeper than a lot of people, and a lot that I know, too. So I want to learn things.
Right.
Primarily, we're here because you have a show. It's Saturday, right?
Saturday.
At the Side Door Cabaret at the Palladium.
At the Palladium.
It's called Pure Imagination.
Right.
It's you and your trio, right? So it's a quartet.
Quartet.
Including you.
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. Yes. Tell me what pure imagination means.
This particular project, I'm obviously doing the theme from Willy Wonka for the show, but the entire show.
wait, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh, because pure imagination.
Pure imagination.
Okay, I'm going to have to suspend some disbelief here. Okay.
Yeah.
What is that, the Candyman?
No, come with me and you'll see.
All right, okay.
I won't be singing.
You're dating me here. Well, that's probably a good thing.
I won't be singing.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So is that the theme? It's just basically...
Well, that one song. I mean, but throughout the entire show, it's more than just that one song. I'm using arrangements from friends of mine, and it's a pool. It's really like a gumbo of creativity, and so... It's something people want to go see. In the past, I've done many shows at the Palladium.
Yeah,
I've done tributes to Michael Brecker. I've done tributes to Miles Davis with James Suggs. I've done Coltrane, and in recent years, I've kind of branched out and made use of some more esoteric themes.
Does that get, I don't know, old is the word, but does that get like, all right? I've done Train. I've done my whole bebop thing, the Charlie Parker thing. Why do it again?
No, not quite. I mean, because there still are audiences for that.
Yeah.
But just for this particular audience at the Palladium, because I've done those things there, like I will still go down to Sarasota or down to Naples or wherever. There's still audience that want to hear the hard bop and the bebop stuff.
Yeah.
But for this particular audience, and because of the Palladium being so free and trusting of me in my artistic ambition and vision.
Oh, that Paul Wilmore.
Yeah, I love Paul. And it seems like the things that I come up with that are most free are, they react to it the best. Like I've done a show called Daydreaming, which was kind of based off the song by Aretha Franklin. Daydreaming and I'm Thinking of You, which was like really dreamy. I used a lot of major chords and stuff like that. I've done Soul of Jazz just recently.
Soul of Jazz, I remember that one.
Yeah, we've done that one a couple
times.
And that's
just sort of an R&B edge kind of thing, a little funk thrown in there.
R&B and funk.
Yeah.
Complete diversion from the jazz stuff, like hard bop Coltrane, where it's just like screaming and...
Yeah,
that sort of expression. Like I always say, expression comes in many forms. So
absolutely,
I like to dive into as many art forms as possible.
And you get an audience every time, right?
I was just talking to my wife before I came out here. Like it's really rewarding to have an audience that will support you no matter what it is. Like some people, they only want to hear Brazilian, or they only want to hear, you know, the things that they want to hear. They want to hear swing.
Yeah,
I've been fortunate enough to cross genres and maintain an audience, and it's really rewarding in that regard.
Jeremy, you're from Omaha.
I am.
Which for me is like, well, that's, it might as well be Mars and Jupiter for me. I mean, I'm a Florida kid, right?
Yeah.
But so what inspired you to take up the sax? I mean, where did that come from?
My mom, actually. She was a fan of Grover Washington.
Uh-huh.
I was a busy kid, and I was actually expelled from school in elementary.
For playing the sax?
No. It was...
You were playing something else, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was playing a lot of things. It was a lot of stuff. No, I mean, my main thing, I would, like, do crayon fights. I was just, like, rambunctious. I didn't listen to the teacher very well.
Uh-huh.
I was kind of a troublemaker.
Well, there are, you know, a lot of us troublemakers survived that period.
Yeah.
You know? So what did that have to do with you picking up the sax?
So, He asked
genuinely.
Yeah. Well, I got expelled. Uh-huh. So I ended up at this I ended up at this little Catholic school called St. Richard's, and they had a music program there. It was the idea of the administrators and my teachers and my parents and everybody involved that I should get into as many extracurriculars as possible.
Oh yeah.
You know, keep him busy.
Yeah.
Keep him busy, burning off some of that energy.
Yeah.
And so one of the things was band. And I didn't get to choose at all. My mom went down there on the day that they were picking instruments to the music store. And because she was a fan of Grover Washington, she selected the sax for me.
And how old were you?
I was 10.
I was going to say.
Nine. So,
would you look at this thing and say, man, this thing's bigger than I am?
Well, you know, it sat under my bed mostly for the first couple of years. I mean, I would take it out. I would take it to school and go to band practice, but it just went under the bed. I never really had any type of fondness for it until after my ninth grade year in high school.
What changed?
I met some really good other musicians. I ran into a guy who a lot of people know now is Terrace Martin. He's a big-time producer. He's worked with Snoop Dogg, Kendrick Lamar, Herbie Hancock, all these guys. I met him there in Omaha, and I also met some of his extended relatives, the Love family. Preston Love played with Count Basie. And just, you know, I had some mentors. And I got bitten by the bug, I guess you could call it.
Was it straight ahead jazz first, or did you know, because Grover kind of comes in the other way,
right?
Kind of poppy soul jazz that he was doing in the 70s, I'm guessing.
Bill, that's a really good question, because that was my mom's vibe.
Yeah,
you know, but I mean, I came up in our house. We went to church a lot, so obviously I was exposed to gospel music.
Yeah.
Down in the basement, the first record that I ever put on myself was Stevie Wonder, My Sharia Moore. You know, he had the little 33s. You had to put the thing in the middle.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I put that.
Tim LaMotown. I remember Yellow Label. I remember that one.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that was all in there, like the gospel music, soul music. I loved James Brown. My parents had a huge collection of records, and I would sit down there for hours and just listening to different music, gospel stuff. I mean, the Beatles. I mean, Van Morrison. They had a really eclectic collection. Look. I don't know what happened. Like, my dad was in Nam, and when he got back, you know, he was kind of a hellraiser. But I was born in 79, so by the time, you know, I was born, my dad had kind of calmed down. So I'm looking through all these old photos of him, you know, shooting his M16 over in Vietnam and, you know, partying and all these records and, you know, the pictures of parties. I'm like, what happened to these people?
That's right. I don't know that. I don't know who are they. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So I kind of came in after the party and all the streamers and stuff are all soggy on the floor.
Well, what occurs to me is you were born in 79, then. When you were kind of coming of age musically, we're talking about like smooth jazz, like Kenny G and all that stuff. So how did you gravitate towards real jazz?
I had some really, really good mentors. A guy by the name of Luigi Waits. I worked with him quite extensively. Like he was really tough. I mean, when I was young, when I was coming up and trying to get my stuff together, I wasn't sure whether the guy liked me or not.
Well, that's what you want in a mentor. You just want to please him. You know, you want to get that approval.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. Like he used cool. to come down on me pretty hard. But in looking back, it was the type of tutelage and advice that I needed. I mean, a lot of this stuff still sticks with me today. Just the way that I conduct myself and the way you form your level of professionalism. You know, a lot of the things that we do in music, and not just music, any artist. The guidelines, the guardrails are pretty murky, or they're misty.
Yeah.
They're fleeting. It's there, and then it's not.
As we've seen historically, sure.
Right? So you have to be flexible. Like, the way that you interact with people, your respect for other people's art, your ability to adapt and appreciate. So, all these lessons that seemed like they were, you know, really, really tough and insurmountable early on were exactly what I needed.
So you didn't become Kenny G, though. You took this kind of gumbo, all this stuff you knew from your parents' record collection.
Yeah, I never really, I mean, honestly.
I don't want to be dissing Kenny G. That's not why I'm
here,
folks.
No. But I totally understand where you're coming from because I've had to do that. Honestly, I was more of a jazzer early on and because I grew up in Nebraska. When I came here, I had to kind of learn more of the commercial pop way of doing my art because I was fortunate enough to kind of just dig into whatever I wanted to in Omaha or in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Like I was, you know, one of the better musicians. And so I didn't really have to adapt very much. I just kind of did whatever I want to. But branching out, coming down here, coming to the South, they're not quite as receptive to, you know, that sort of music. They're used to hearing rock and blues and country and things like that.
Well, also, if you want to do it to make a living, a little conformity involved there. When did you come down here and why?
I came down in 2001, in July of 2001, and I was just basically trying to get out of Omaha. Uh-huh. I got sick of the winters there, and honestly, I took things as far as I could there. I kind of felt like, even at that age, I don't know, I was, what, 20, 21, I was maxed out there. I mean, I'd done everything there kind of was to do around there.
But why here? Just because it was warm?
No, my parents were here. They retired here. It was an easy transition.
Yeah.
We'd come down here on vacation. My entire family's military, so we used to, you know, travel down to Alabama where they were from and go down to Pensacola and Tampa. So we were familiar with the area, and I came down here honestly just for a vacation and ended up staying.
What did you discover? The jazz scene now, I came back in 2014 after being away, and when I was coming up in St. Petersburg, this was Deadsville. There was nothing happening here.
Yeah.
I mean, it seemed to a kid anyway.
Right.
And when I came back, it's like it's bubbling over. What was it like when you came here musically?
You know, there was a lot of guys around. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't think it's what it is now. It's just different. You know, time changes. But like back then, we lost a lot of guys. You know, Chick Corea, people don't really consider him as a, you know, St. Pete Clearwater guy, but he had a studio up there
in
Clearwater. He was highly connected with the Scientologists and things like that. Kenny Drew Jr., you know, he was here. We lost him, you know. George Algar, a lot of really great musicians were here that we've lost over the years. Dan McMillian, you know, Bob McCarr, like all these guys that were part of the scene. We lost a lot of guys. Now we kind of have a new crop. Like I said, I was 21, 22 when I came down here.
Now you're the old guy.
I'll be 45 this year.
Well, how did that affect, like, you know, your own sort of personal evolution as a musician? To as you say, you had to make some adjustments to play down here. But, you know, was it sort of like, hey, did it up your game, I guess, is what I'm saying?
Probably not, no.
Okay, well, at least you're honest.
No, I mean, you know, honestly, the things that my highest periods of growth, I don't think came necessarily from anything in the Tampa Bay area. I mean, if anything, because I worked in wedding bands and corporate bands for a long time, and I kind of feel like my artistic integrity was compromised a little bit because I had a family and I had to worry about finances,
right?
Like we all do. And so I think business-wise, the opportunity that this area has provided me have been tremendous with all the retirees and the country clubs and resorts and opportunities to perform and put on great concerts is amazing between Tampa Bay, Orlando, Naples, Miami. You have a tremendous community and resource here. But artistically, you have to be really focused. And my biggest periods of growth was when I would go out on tour with, you know, bands from Argentina or go up to New York and really get in the grinder with guys who were digging into the music on a different level, the seriousness of the music in New York. Like, you got to make that rent.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Every
right.
month. And so there's, I mean, even the guys who are on the bottom of the rung, they have a focus and commitment that is kind of unlike yours. You know, living in Florida, you get to chill and go to the beach and stuff like that. They don't know anything about that.
That's all they do is work.
Yeah.
You know, and I sort of figure that people maybe don't understand that, you know, well, I'm an artist and I declare myself an artist and this is what I do for a living, that there are still parameters, because it is still, as we always talk about with visual artists, it's still a business.
Yeah.
You're trying to, is this all you do?
Yeah.
Okay.
For many years. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Right. And you teach as well, right?
I teach. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was just saying, I did a television interview last week. I wear just about every bin or hat in a bin rather, out of necessity. You know, everybody was affected by COVID. So live performances were more or less non-existent. So just to stay relevant, you start teaching, you start doing internet stuff, podcasting, collaborating with other people, recording, you know, you get pretty versatile and creative.
Can technique be taught? Say some kid comes to you and his parents have some money and they're, hey, teach my kid. Can you teach technique? I mean, is it sort of, you can either play this thing and get something cool out of it, or you can't?
No, you can teach technique. Yeah. And that's a really good question, because I have students who come to me, and you know, like, everybody's like, of course, looking for a magic bullet, but there's some very tangible things that you can take from just trying to learn an instrument, because like, when you face these areas of difficulty, whether it's a scale or it's a harmonic passage or somebody's material, you have to study it. And these moments occur to kind of ask you, do you really want this, or do you just like to talk?
You that's kind of like journalism.
Yes. And so, and then whatever that answer is, that's how you proceed. That's going to dictate how you proceed. You know, if you are still in the face of difficulty and being rejected and disappointment and all this, and you still want to forge ahead, then yes. If the answer is no, then no.
Can taste be taught?
Absolutely not.
That was a loaded question, okay?
Or at least I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, you may need somebody smarter than me to dig into that one.
Did you, I don't know, this is something I wrote down, and maybe it's articulate, maybe it's not, but screw it, I'll ask it anyway. I wondered if you reached a point during your musical journey where you felt more or less comfortable. I can sit in with anybody. You're in a club and somebody says, hey, Jeremy, you got your sax, you know? And it's like, yeah, I can do that. Or is there like a line you cross where before that it's like, I don't know, these guys are too good. Or do you feel like I could do that now?
Yeah.
Well, now, of course.
But, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's a really good question. I don't think it's like out of like confidence or cockiness or overconfidence. I think it's just... I'm at a place in my life where I'm comfortable with who I am. Like, I'm comfortable in my own skin, you know, and I'm realistic about what it is. You know what I mean? I'm confident in my ability to play. And I think I have something to say, regardless of the context, even if the musicianship is super high or if it's super low, I think we can still commune and break bread. You know, I think that the thing is larger than that.
The thing is larger than that. I'm calling this story that, actually. What was I going to say? Is it possible? You go up and somebody says, this tune is in E-flat. And you go, oh, man, I can't play an E-flat. That's like my worst key. Does that ever happen?
No.
No, you're just too good.
No. I mean, no, seriously, that's one of the things that I practice. I mean, you're put in these situations with enough experience, like... they'll play a song, and I mean, that's one of the, I'm a stickler for that. I practice in all keys. I do a lot. practice a lot. In situations that you would probably never think of. I'm pretty ferocious with practice and very focused. And not to some technical end. Like, I want to be better, but there's the technical aspect, and then like I said, you have to be passionate about what it is you do.
Yeah.
And more specifically, you have to have a voice. So like you were asking, like, would I get nervous or feel like inadequate to sit in maybe at Lincoln Center with Winton? Like, absolutely not. I mean, they've never heard me. I think that there are things that only I can do.
Does it also happen too that you're playing, I don't know, Ruby's Elixir or the one by the airport, I can't think of the name. The Hangar. I don't know if you do those gigs, but or if you don't do that stuff. But I mean, is it also possible that somebody says, or Suggs walks in the door, Suggs can get up and play with you? I mean, you get a kind of a rapport with people. You know how good they are. And, yeah, we can do something cool together.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we've worked together a lot.
The
first band from Argentina that I was talking about, Los Pericos, James actually introduced me to them. And some of the trips and tours that we went on together were just, it was magic. It was absolutely magic. Just from our rapport and having talked to each other and sat down and broke bread and understand each other as people and, like, know where our tastes lie.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then being able to depend on one another to perform as a unit.
That's what you need as a band. And it's like, you know, I'm going to fall backwards. I know you'll catch me.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Right.
Or, you know what, you can come this way, I got you.
Right.
You know, and I love that kind of unspoken thing between musicians.
Yeah.
And I can't think of the word right now. It's some kind of telepathy.
Simpatico or
something. Yeah. Well, it's a simpatico telepathy. Let's go there.
Yeah.
That works. talk to me about the group that you're playing with Saturday night. Who's in the band?
I have Rod Alnord, one of my newest members, on drums. Mm-hmm. Young guy, fiery guy, astute. He's hungry. And cool. I love to let him off the chain and just let him cut loose, man. He's like really energetic and really excited about the music. I love what he brings. I also have Patrick Bettison playing on keyboards.
Yeah.
I fibbed a little bit. Patrick is a special guest of mine. I have my quartet, including me, but Patrick is also going to be sitting in with
yeah,
us.
Yeah, I've seen Patrick play. He's great.
Yeah, he's going to be playing a little piano and harmonica. Uh-huh. And then I'm going to be playing piano on the show as well.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You're playing sax too, aren't you?
I'm playing sax and piano.
All right, well, that's cool.
I have Elias Tona.
Yeah.
Playing bass.
Right.
Who is, I think he's still out on the road with Al D. Miller right now. He's going to be coming back.
Are he and Gumby do that together?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, Elias is great.
Yeah, he's amazing.
And LaRue, I think, right?
And LaRue's in the group as
LaRue
well.
LaRue Nicholson.
Yeah, LaRue was just there with his group. LaRue's been in my group for a number of years now. I love what he brings, like with the rock element. You know, personally, artistically, I think it's a really good blend.
He's a great guitar
blend
player.
Of styles, yeah.
He really is. Well, it's called Pure Imagination. It's Saturday, and that's June 29th, depending on when you're listening to this, at 8 o'clock at the Sidedoor Cabaret in the Palladium Theater. You can find tickets at mypalladium.org. You're welcome, Paul. Jeremy Carter, always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
I mean,
for having
always me. A pleasure. We just met, but we've spoken before, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And, you know, I don't know if you say break a leg or have a great gig or what do you say?
I don't know. Hot jazz.
Yeah, that works.
Hot and sexy.
Yeah. See, we'll see you Saturday, man.
See you.